So this is the last day of our Rohatsu retreat, our 7-day retreat, which we have been doing for many, many, many years. And the theme of my talks, Ted gave the first three, and then I'm giving the last four. The theme of my talks has been a pilgrimage through not knowing to intimacy. A pilgrimage. And as I said yesterday, that the day before, being a pilgrim is different than being a tourist, because a tourist is trying to gather experience. A pilgrim is trying to satisfy a deep longing for connectedness, for something beyond the small little self. Whether it's Catholic or Christian or Buddhist or Muslim, and for us in particular, as Zen people, we encounter not knowing along the way. But of course, all pilgrims come up against not knowing. And Ted and I have been using the three classic Chan books. Classic books, gonglong books of gonglongs, koans, that really define Zen and its origins, the Gateless Barrier, the Book of Serenity, and the Blue Cliff Records. So I'm going to talk about a couple of cases from those today, and I'll see if I can pull them off, which I've also been practicing for a while. So these cases that were passed down to us, challenge our either-or thinking. Challenge our thinking based on not having enough knowledge, wanting more knowledge, having too much knowledge, and they open the door so that we can move through not knowing to intimacy, to closeness. So as we walk outside, and we've been walking outside in this retreat twice a day, we seem to go places, but our deepest aspiration is to sustain a pilgrimage into the unknown, into the still mind, the still heart, right in here. So our challenge is to walk the trails inside us of feelings and sensations, and let ourselves sometimes be turned upside down and back right side up. And upside down or right side up, because the trail to touch heart mind, to touch the center of being is not linear. We have to pass through lots of wilderness, lots of wildness. And as I was saying yesterday, or maybe the day before, if we're on a mountain trail, we have cairns or ducks, if the trail is indistinct, to mark where we should go. Those are important. They give us some guidance about how to proceed. And Dogen and Suzuki and Katagiri and all the great teachers have given us cairns, continue to give us cairns, continue to give us markers along this path where we don't know. And here's one by Dogen. Dogen's cairns sometimes, seem really confusing. But if we just pay attention to it. Just go toward it. It teaches us something. So here's one by Dogen. Once the fists and noses have all taken up residence in the halls of the monastery. Well, there you go. Already he's confusing us, right? They hang up their traveling bag in their place for the duration of the retreat. They hang up their traveling bag in their place for the duration of the retreat. So the fists, when we explore the trails, we need to do them with our body mind, not just with our mind. Our mind is looking for the next cairn, but with our body mind, with the fists, we explore the trail, not knowing anything. With our noses, the breath of life, the breath of Dharma. Each stopping place, each breath, another cairn on the trail. So that's what Dogen seems to be saying, although, you know, he can be interpreted so many different ways. But that's what he's saying to me right now. So many of you heard me tell a story about when I was only 9 years old, climbing a high peak in California in the Sierras. And there were lots of cairns along the way. Then when we got to Timberline, there were no cairns. There were no ducks anymore. And I had so depended on those to come from Golden Trail Camp up to there. And then to have Timberline with no cairns, and I was already exhausted, I just sat down and cried. I sat down and cried. I just looked, and it looked desolate. I don't know if you know what, most of you have been to Timberline. You know, it just looks desolate. No markers in that Timberline. No cairns. I just cried. And then my mother was there with me, luckily. Of course, I wouldn't have done it without my mother. I was only 9. And my dad was with me, too, but he was far ahead on the trail, the way men tend to go. Those men. My mother was there. And my mother said, "Tim, you just have to take one step." "Okay, Mom." Mommy, I called her. And I took one step. And I sat down and cried, and she said, "Tim, you just have to take another step." And she said, "And you know, you could take a breath too." So my mother knew nothing about Buddhism, nothing about meditation. But because of her guidance, I did it. I went all the way to the top. Well, that was it. Those were her cairns. Those were her markers. And we need cairns. We need help because this pilgrimage is not easy for us. It's not just the Rahatsu pilgrimage. It's our life pilgrimage. A pilgrimage is defined as a journey, often to an unknown or foreign place, where a person goes in search of new or expanded meaning about their self, about others, about nature, or a higher good through their experience. And it can lead to a personal transformation, after which the pilgrim returns to daily life. So Rahatsu, formally in Zen, is our biggest pilgrimage. But informally, we're always, if we keep our longing to just be present in this world and open up to heart, mind alive, we're always on pilgrimage. But Rahatsu in particular, we're honoring and participating in the historical Buddha's final phase of his pilgrimage, the end of his six years, he just, according to the myth, he sat silently doing nothing. According to the myth, he gave up striving. He let the crust of ego and defense mechanisms crack open. He realized that his little needy self was just a protected by a layer of being, and he opened it up into his heart mind. He didn't diss it. It just opened up itself into heart mind. And then supposedly, according to the myth, he said when the three guys who had been meditating with him met him, he said, "Only I, alone and sacred. But that I includes all life. It includes all life. Intimacy." So now I'm going to do the first, now I'm going to try to call up the first koan. And I think I can do that by doing share screen. Just be patient with me for a moment. You can breathe. Share screen. And then, oh, let's see. Can you see it? Oh, that's the wrong one. Huh. Let's see. Now I've got to go up, I think. Okay. Can you see it? Raise your hand if you can see it. I can only see a couple of you. So Raymond or Steve, would you raise your hand if you can see it? Great. Okay. Case 20 from the Book of Serenity. Dizong asks Fayan, "Where are you going?" Fion said, "I am on pilgrimage, wandering aimlessly." Dizong said, "What do you think about this wandering?" Fion said, "I don't know." Dizong said, "Not knowing is most intimate." So, wandering aimlessly, aimlessly. Sometimes we feel that way. We're sitting down to meditate, and then we're wandering aimlessly. The mind often seems to move haphazardly through different patterns of thinking and feeling. It's not bad. It happens to everyone. We just try to bring it back on the trail over and over. Try to bring it back to the trail using some cairn from something we repeat to ourselves or something a teacher said to us to help us. But sometimes there are hardly any cairns. They're few and far between. And especially in a long retreat, we have no cairns. Ah, but then can we sink into don't know? Because we have lots of cairns, we know. But if we have less cairns, less markers on the trail, can we sink into don't know deeper and deeper? Dizong discovered the great intimacy of not knowing, whereas Fion's don't know was caught in how long it'll be till the next cairn. And is it possible to get to the top? And we get caught in that. And then we just come back. We just come back. And sometimes we need to sink pretty deeply into don't know before we can come back. And we get kind of discouraged. And that's okay. It's natural to get discouraged. I got pretty discouraged. I got pretty discouraged when I was 9. And also when I was in my first years of doing Zen practice, I got very discouraged. Going deeper means not needing so many cairns and just being willing to be what is, with what is. As my teacher said, if you want to tame your sheep or your cow, give it a large pasture. If you give them this space, they may seem aimless, just wandering around aimlessly, but they're following an inner gyroscope, even though they don't know it. Can we allow them, these sheeps and cows, that much space with no idea what will happen? Can we trust them to find their way on the trail home to heart mind? Can we do that? I think so. I think so. Instead of beating ourselves up for all our wandering, can there be deep appreciation for just the wandering mind? Because the mind is a wandering mind. Why does it wander? Because it's trying to protect us. It's trying to protect us. It's trying to check everything out. Yesterday, today, tomorrow, what should happen? To protect us. But if we just allow ourselves to sink deeply into don't know, then at some point we don't need to know. And we just really enjoy and appreciate our lives. Story I've told many times about picking my teacher up at the airport in San Francisco when he had been at Trudy Dixon's ranch in Montana. And I asked him, what kind of a time he'd have? He said, "Good time." And I said, "What did you do?" He said, "Rode horses." And I said, "I don't think you knew how to ride horses." He said, I don't know. The horse knows." So the horse knows. whoever you want to make the horse. As soon as you make it into something, you lose your vitality. You lose your vitality. You lose your life. In a way, you lose your life because you become so bottled up. But can you sink so deeply into don't know that your mind gets really calm on its own? Instead of worrying about trying to get calm, instead of comparing this calmness to the last calmness, instead of worrying about having a good result or having to fix your suffering or someone else's suffering, just settling in to don't know, So twice a day in Zen monasteries and twice a day here during Rahatsu, we've been repeating the Heart Sutra, being somewhat intelligible to the uninitiated, to the person who hasn't studied at all or heard it much. It's somewhat unintelligible Heart Sutra, which keeps saying, no, 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 no. We're no one and nothing because everything is empty. Everything is empty. We're no, oh, no, 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 no. But then it ends and it says, Bodhisvaha, because we're no one and nothing, because we've let go of all this crud that just keeps us weighted down, we can be anyone and anything. We are anyone and anything. So now I'm going to leave this case, which I will do just by this, and keep talking a little bit. So Jane Hirschfield, I quoted in my last Dharma talk, or maybe the one before, the poet, the Zen Buddhist poet, who we did a series on in the summer. And she's coming. She's coming to Zen Center, which is kind of exciting. I'm excited that she's going to be coming. She's coming online, that is, in February, coming online to give a talk and to lead a workshop. Anyway, I quoted her poem last time. Even now, decades after, I wash my face with cold water. Oh, not for discipline, nor memory, nor the icy awakening slap, but to practice choosing to make the unwanted wanted. She lived at Tassajara Zen Monastery for, I don't know, at least a couple of years. And before that, and after that, she settled at Green Gulch Practice Center. Tassajara is pretty rugged. Anyway, even now, decades after, I wash my face with cold water. She's talking about Tassajara. Not for discipline, not for memory, nor the icy awakening slap, but to practice choosing not to make the wanted unwanted. Yes, the unwanted is always intruding into our lives when we just think we've got our practice down. We've got our cairns in place. We're on the trail. We're doing pretty good. And then something happens to all of us. I had my Lyme's disease. After that, my Lyme's disease seemed better for a while. Then it got worse. Then it got better. Then I tore a tendon in my foot. Then I had to hobble around Zen Center. Then when I would talk about when I was hobbling around Zen Center and I talked about it, we were having a practice period. And you know, in a practice period, everybody is assigned a practice partner. Some people like their practice partners, but some people actually complain to me about their practice partners, which is fine. So I was in my Dharma talk, I said, I didn't ask for this practice partner. I don't like this practice partner. I'm trying to pay attention to his needs and be with him, but I don't like him. We don't always like the practice partner we get, do we? But I just did my best to stay with him, and we healed. We healed. It took a while, but we healed together. We call this self-power in Zen. Planting ourselves deeply in the nature of what surrounds us, in the nature of this, so that we can be intimate with whatever difficulty comes and just give it a hug, because it's what is. It's what is. This is the practice partner we've got. When we do that, we're not caught so much in the chatterbox cafe, because we know this is our practice partner and we just give it a hug. Beyond our calculating minds, which warn us to be wary of things that are different and out of the ordinary, afraid of anything that feels out of control. and our body and our world, in case you haven't noticed it, is full of areas that are wild. Talk about the pandemic. Wild. But the wild regulates itself quite well. It does. It regulates itself. And what did Suzuki Roshi say? The best way to tame those sheep and those cows is to give them a large pasture. And my foot healed. It 100% healed. Oh, maybe not 100%. It 90% healed. But sometimes things won't heal. There are other things in my body that are never going to heal. I don't know if I'm ever going to be able to do full-length bows again. Maybe so. Maybe so. Maybe not. Some things won't heal. But can we plant ourselves deeply in this, in listening to and paying attention and caring for this situation, this body, this mind, these relationships? This is what we have. This is what we have. And Leonard Cohen, as many of you know, practiced Zen for many, many years, many, many years. And toward the end of his life, I think this is toward the end of his life, when he was having difficulty himself physically, he wrote this stanza. Ring the bells that still can ring. There is a crack in everything that shows how the light gets in. So there's a crack in everything. Lucky us. That's where the light gets in. Lucky us. So during this retreat, as I said, we have two walks every day. Time and nature. When we have a chance to see that the wild doesn't mean crazed. It's simply what is. Just what is. When we can take refuge. When we take refuge in Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, we don't take refuge from wildness. We use them as cairns, Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, to help us just stay in wildness, just go deeper into wildness. Terry Tempest Williams says, to be whole, to be complete, wildness reminds us what it means to be human. Wildness reminds us what we are connected to rather than what we are separate from. Wildness. Our pilgrimage into intimacy can only happen if we merge ourselves in the wildness of the natural world. And you know, our bodies are part of the natural world. Your body may not be cooperating, but if you treat it as your great practice partner, it's part of the natural world. It naturally knows what to do and how to be. So now I'm going to do the second case for today. And let's see if I can do this. I'm going to share screen. Okay, now I'm going to go down. Can you see it now? Raise your hand if you can see it. Thank you, Raymond. This is case 10 in the Gateless Barrier. Case 10 in the Gateless Barrier. A student of the intimacy, or a student of intimacy, came to Master Saoshan. He said, my name is Qing Shui. I am solitary and destitute. I'm solitary and destitute. Please give me alms. And of course, he's not asking for something material. He's coming to his teacher and said, please, I'm aching inside. I'm longing to fall into what you seem to imbibe. Please give me alms. And the teacher responds, Venerable Shui. Qing Shui immediately responded, yes. Saoshan replies, You've already sipped 3 glasses of the finest wine in the nation, and yet you say you've not put the cup to your lips? So we're all students of intimacy. This is Soto Zen. We're students of intimacy. And it goes back mythologically to Mahakashyapa, the myth, the birth myth is that the Mahakashyapa myth, which you all know, is that Buddha held up the flower, and Mahakashyapa, only Mahakashyapa out of the 2,000 people who were there, smiled. There was intimacy between Buddha and Mahakashyapa. The others didn't get it. There wasn't that marriage. They weren't settled into just the don't know so deeply they could be intimate. But he could. Now, this is a myth, right? But we consider that our first transmission based on intimacy. That's our mythology. And in those of you who have been initiated or who get ordained in your Dharma paper, in your lineage paper, you'll see that he's number two after Buddha because we go through the whole lineage. So Kung Shui, we assume, we know something about him. He was a student of the wild, a student of intimacy, but he was feeling isolated and alone. If you do a full day of Sesshin, if you're not chattering the whole time, a whole day of retreat, you're going to feel isolated, alone at some point. You will. It's inevitable. But he was on a pilgrimage. He didn't know what was going on, and he stayed with it. Can we stay with it on our pilgrimage? Using each other as cairns, using Dogen and other teachers as cairns. Can we stay with it so that we can go deeper beyond the marked trails? To heart mind. So how can we heal the ache of our lives? The ache of our lives, the ache of solitary and destitute. When we can take solitary and destitute and think of it in many different ways, we can think of it literally as being homeless. The homeless people by the library in Uptown. There are 3 tents left. There were 13 tents 3 weeks ago. What happened to those 10 people in their tents? Where are they now? Are they trying to cram themselves in a homeless shelter someplace? Are they under the bridge someplace? Oh, the ache of solitariness and destitution. No income. Even middle class people who've lost their jobs. Some of you guys, no other income than what you had, and now it's shut down. Wandering in a mass of confusion. Perhaps not even fully understanding what's going on. Who can? It's don't know. And about those homeless people? That's embarrassing. I feel embarrassed that there's still people living outside. And I used to work hard on diminishing that. But I haven't worked on it lately. And I feel sad and embarrassed about that. So literal homelessness in this country, literal homelessness, which we had big time in the Great Depression. Oh, let's not do that. Let's take care of each other. Let's support each other so we don't go down that road. We went down that road because of a few who were so afraid that they were afraid of the many. But the few are the many. The many are the few. This little heart mind is big heart mind. So we have literal ache of solitary and destitute. Then we have psychological ache. Oh, tired of social distancing. How long have I been doing this? I thought it was going to be over at the end of March. And then I thought it was going to be over in midsummer. And then I thought it was going to be over. Right? Tired of it. Tired of this physical separation. And not being able to just hold a friend's hand. Not just being able to hold a friend's hand. Not just being able to give my grandson a hug, whom now I don't know when I'm ever going to see him again. Oh. Solitary and destitute. In 9th and 10th century China, this is the golden age of Chinese Zen. But if you study the Tang Dynasty, the later Tang Dynasty, 9th and 10th century, which I studied a little more than 50 years ago, but I tend to retain stuff I studied. I forget everything else. My wife wishes I just forget the stuff I studied and remember everything else. I try to, but for some reason, I only remember the stuff I study. This was a time in Tang Dynasty China of physical and psychological destitution and loneliness. Precarious of life was present all around. So this time is not so different from that time. This moment, which I've never experienced this time in 77 years before this year. This precariousness, the not knowing. Everything seems to be falling apart. In so many ways. And when Dogen lived, which was after the Tang Dynasty, the beginning of the 13th century, this was also a time of great tumult, of great psychological and spiritual impoverishment. And so much so that the other Buddhist leaders in the 13th century, said, this is the fallen age of Buddhism. We're in the fallen age because Buddha in one of his prophecies said that in the first 500 years, my Dharma will flourish. In the second 500 years, it will kind of begin to wither. And in the third 500 years, it will just, in some versions, he said the first 1,000 years. Anyway, 13th century Japan, which was very Buddhist, they said, we're in the fallen age. And as a result, Shinran in particular, the founder of Shin School, said, people can't meditate. It's too hard for them. And they certainly can't attain enlightenment. But Dogen said, oh, this is just in, he didn't say it this way. This is the way I'm saying it. He said, this is just in your head. The third age, the first age, the second age. We're just where we are. Let's take care of it. Let's not get hung up on what age it is. And here is actually what he did say. He said, but he went on and on about this in many occasions. But here's what he said on once when people were complaining to him about the fallen age. His monks, I assume, because mostly he hung out with his monks. The ancient sages were not necessarily of sturdy build, nor were all the forebearers richly endowed. And when we consider Buddha's lifetime, not all people were superior. There were both sheep and goats. Among monastics, there were unimaginable villains. And others were of the lowest character. First age, second age, third age, eighth age. This is what it is. Let's just take care of it. Let's just be with it. Now my other computer went out, so I have to just do what my wife told me to do to get it back. So let's just, why don't you just breathe for a moment while I do that. breathe for 3 moments, breathe for 33 moments. I need to get my wife. Hold on for a second. Linda, can you help me? Well, I can't call it up.
All right, so I'm going LP15LP. Yeah, I was holding it down.
But don't you have to get the?
Oh, it's up already. Oh, well, I see. You can't find your you've disappeared your lecture. Okay, well, we'll go get it again here.
Can you hear my wife in the background? I'm lucky to have her.
Yes.
She said yes.
Yes. Male. Male.
Just breathing here together.
Yes. I'm trying to rescue his computer problem while he gives a lecture.
So many people can hear.
Your lecture is just an illusion anyways.
That's right. Don't get attached to it.
Oh, who's the Roshi in the room?
Okay, here you go.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. I met her at Zen Center in San Francisco, you guys, many, many years ago. She's been helping me ever since. Okay. Now I've got to find my place. This went out, this happened day before yesterday, and you were also patient then, but I couldn't even get it back then, so I just kept talking. So I've been talking about the third age really saying that that's just an arbitrary kind of distinction. We always think we're in a fallen age. This is where we are. This is where we are. And the third kind of destitution and solitariness, the first is physical. Those homeless people losing our job. Maybe we won't have enough food. Maybe the food stamps will run out. Psychological. And the third is spiritual. The third is spiritual. And spiritual destitution is what this monk is talking about. Spiritual destitution. Spiritual loneliness. Spiritual longing for something we don't have. I am solitary and destitute, he says to the teacher. Please give me alms. So this is unique to those of us who are seeking, that often we feel impoverished. We go and enter into a dark night, a place of real darkness where there aren't any cairns or any trail. And we sink farther into don't know, but it's so dark, there's nothing. But this is important. It means we really are going deeper. And we might say, help, help. That's fine. Say, help, help. We have the possibility to fall into our mind, which is always right here. A deep awareness that everything we believe in, everything we value is gone. And then, but heart mind is here. So instead of turning to some pleasure, some social media, or courageous, or being, let's be courageously honest, like Shui. This is where I am. What should I do now? He doesn't realize that his feeling of being enveloped by darkness, totally isolated, alone, means he's very close in his pilgrimage to opening up to heart mind. But his teacher's there with him, and teacher helps him. You may think his teacher's not helping him, but I think his teacher's helping him. Helping him let go of his desire to be anything more than what he is already. And his teacher says, you've already sipped 3 glasses of the finest wine in the nation. That's pretty good. You've already sipped 3 glasses of the finest wine in the nation. That's pretty good. We've already sipped that. That's what our teachers remind us of. So there's a lot of stories about pilgrimages throughout Zen and Chan. In The Hidden Lamp, which I think you guys studied with Ben in spring practice period, I think you did, there's stories from 25 centuries of awakened women. And here's one about Chiono. Chiono was a servant. Let's see. I lost it again, so I'm finding it. Chiono was a servant in a Zen convent who wanted to practice Zazen. One day she approached an elderly nun and said, I'm of humble birth. I can't read or write. I must work all the time. Is there any possibility? Is there any possibility that I could attain the way of Buddha, even though I have no skills? This is wonderful, my dear. In Buddhism, there are no distinctions between people. There is only this. Each person must hold fast to the desire to awaken and cultivate a heart of great compassion. People are completely as they are. If you don't fall into delusive thoughts, there is no Buddha and no sentient being. There is only complete nature. If you want to know your true nature, you need to turn toward the source of your delusive thoughts. This is called Zazen. Chiono said with happiness, with this practice as my companion, I have only to go about my daily life, practicing day and night. Wow, that's all we have to do. Practice day and night. That sounds kind of arduous, doesn't it? Only have to go about practicing day and night. Well, let's just say living day and night. Just say living and breathing day and night. What are you trying to, if you're trying to practice for the performance later on, you'll always be agitated. But here's the performance, just breathing, just being what is, whatever it is. That's the performance. With this practice as my companion, she said, I only have to go about my daily life. After months of wholehearted practice, she went out on a full moon night to draw some water from the well. The bottom of her old bucket, held together by bamboo strips, suddenly gave way, and the reflection of the moon vanished with the water. When she saw this, she attained great realization. And then she wrote a poem. With this and that, I tried to keep the bucket together, and then the bottom completely fell out. With this and that, I tried to keep the bucket together, and then the bottom completely fell out. So her teacher said, if you want to know your true nature, you need to turn toward the source of your delusive thoughts. Turn toward them. That's the door to liberation. Even into the depths of hell inside. On the trail. And if there are no, on the trail, their inner trail, the trail of sensations and feelings. And if there are no cairns, use your breath as a cairn. Use your step as a cairn. Chiono senses that, and at the same time, she tries to hold it together. With this and that, I tried to keep the bucket together, scrambling to hold it together, to maintain, to look the part. After people get ordained, they really want to look the part. They really want to hold it together, but their robes are flopping all over the place. Even if you don't get ordained, after about 2 days in the retreat, you're just trying to just make it through the next breath, and all your mind is just wandering all over the place. Same thing. We're on pilgrimage, so we're practicing moment by moment. And when we least expect it, the bottom falls out because we forget ourselves. Dogen calls this forgetting the self and being intimate with all life. We let our concepts of improving our meditation go, and we're truly poor. We let our concept of being poorly poor go. We get attached to being truly poor, and then we get to be destitute. Oh, we get attached to being destitute. We let it go. And we feel close. We don't even have a word, intimate. Close, because we're joined by all life. All life's protecting us. We're protecting it. Close. Lao Tzu said, he who collects concepts gains something every day. He who follows the way loses something every day. Loses something. So our own little heart mind is the heart mind of the universe. Just started where we end where we start. But to really imbibe this, we have to be willing to pass through feeling solitary and destitute. Pilgrims on a path of not knowing. And then we can open up into only I, alone and sacred. Only you, alone and sacred. Only you. Only her, only him, only it, alone and sacred, with all life. So, thank you.